Good morning and welcome to the Coastal Commission meeting for September 16th. And could the clerk please call the roll?
Commissioner Reese.
Here.
Commissioner Blank.
Here.
Commissioner Bloom.
Here.
Commissioner Secord.
Present.
Commissioner Crewer.
Here.
Commissioner Mercurimi.
Present.
Commissioner Sanchez.
Here.
Commissioner Schallenberger.
Here.
Commissioner Stone.
Here.
Commissioner Wan.
Here.
Chair Neely.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. And let's go to staff to go over the changes in the agenda.
Morning, commissioners. There are two changes to the agenda, which are included on a handout that you received yesterday or this morning. And those changes are, first of all, on page 11 of the agenda, item 8A, which is the application 1-10-14 of Dias. That's moving to consent. And the second change is also on page 11, and that's item 9A, which is the permit amendment request of the Humboldt County Department of Public Works, and we're also moving that to consent. And that concludes the changes. I will take this opportunity to make a few announcements. For anyone in the audience that would like to address the commission today, it'll be necessary for you to fill out a speaker slip, which is contained on the table at the entry to the hall here. And if you fill that out and give it to a staff member, we'd appreciate that. The table also contains addenda for today's items, and there's copies of staff reports in the binder if people would like to refer to that. And then finally, if you have cell phones, please put them in a mode that won't disrupt the meeting. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Commissioner Wan, did you have a comment?
Yes, just a quick comment. I wanted to thank Chair Neely for the lovely dinner she had for commissioners and staff last night, and we really appreciate it. Your hospitality was great.
Thank you. Well, it's really important to the area to have the Coastal Commission here to be able to see what potential projects in the future are and to just kind of get a sense for the North Coast, and I just want to thank you for continuing to have meetings here at least once a year. So, anyway, sorry about the weather, though. Can't do everything.
I'd also like to thank the staff and chair for the site visits yesterday. I thought they were incredibly informative, particularly the ones we could actually physically go see from inside. But I thought they all, inside and out, gave us a better perspective of issues coming in front of the commission.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Commissioner Bloom?
Just let me add my thoughts on that also. I was really pleased to be able to have the tour yesterday, and really my only disappointment, particularly, you know, I don't have the opportunity coming from Southern California to, even if I wanted to, come up here and look at projects or potential projects, but this one in particular, to not be able to get on site and it being right across the street from where we are, was pretty frustrating to not be able to get a closer look. I think it would have been very helpful had we been able to.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, let's move now to public comment. This is general public comment on items that are not on the agenda. We have four speakers. Sandra Jerebek is first, followed by Scott Greeson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Sandra Jerebek, and I live and work in Del Norte County. I come to you from the wilds about 2 hours north of here. And I live in a county so remote and isolated that people try to get away with things that they would never dream of doing down south. And I'm going to talk to you about a couple of those things this morning. And in fact, we are so remote and isolated that the commission hasn't met in our county yet. I hope someday you will. Without the Coastal Commission, in terms of environmental issues, there's really no law north of the Klamath River. For example, in January, we were astounded when the Del Norte County Board of Supervisors started putting up signs for an off-road vehicle trail through the middle of the Pacific Shore subdivision, leading to a new recreation area on the coast that they had established, and they did all of this without any permits or environmental documents. Because your commission acted quickly, they took the signs down, but they still haven't rescinded the order establishing this illegal off-road vehicle trail, and this recreation area on the beach on lands that are subject to State Lands Commission jurisdiction. And this trail leads directly to areas in Tolowa Dunes State Park and the Lake Earl Wildlife Area, which are being trashed to this day. So we would like you to ask them and make it a higher priority to get them to rescind the ordinance establishing this trail and make a public example of this. No one would do this in Humboldt. I know the Board of Supervisors wouldn't. The second thing I want to talk to you about is Tolowa Dunes State Park, which is a very unique area ecologically and historically. Last winter, State Parks Director Ruth Coleman decided to try to give away 1,200 acres of Tolowa Dunes State Park to Fish and Game for duck hunting. The park is named for the Tolowa Indians, which live in the area, and the part she tried to give away to Fish and Game includes the center of their universe, their cemeteries of their ancestors, and the area of their genesis. She did this without CEQA, without a coastal permit, without even talking to the Tolowa Indians. After protest, that didn't happen, but now she is bringing forward to the State Parks Commission a smaller proposal to declassify Tolowa Dunes State Park, to reclassify it at the State Parks Commission to allow waterfowl hunting without your permit or CEQA or anything. And I have for each of you a packet, including a letter of opposition from the Tolowa Indians and statewide groups and a map of the area. If I could distribute this, please, and thank you very much. I know I'm over.
Yeah, thank you. All right. Commissioner Juan?
Yeah, on two things. One, on this OHV use issue, that is pretty serious because in addition to everything else, it is leading into this whole Tolowa Dunes State Park issue where there's a great concern once that becomes a state recreation area. That's where the OHV use is going to be, and it's going to be on some very, very sensitive habitat areas. So we're not just talking, by the way, about duck hunting. We're talking about the impacts to the habitat for many more species than just waterfowl.
All right. Thank you. Scott Greason? Or did you want to comment, staff? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just a comment on that. Sorry. You're absolutely right, Commissioner Juan, and we're very aware of the situation up there. It is being investigated. We've directed the county to remove the placards indicating the OHV sign, and we're investigating the issue of the rescission of the ordinance.
All right. Sorry, Scott. Go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair and Commissioners, for the chance to address you this morning. My name is Scott Greason. I'm the Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. I'm here today to implore you to act to push back against and, if possible, prevent the state park's attempt to reclassify this portion of Tolowa Dunes State Park. This would reduce protections for a critically important natural area, one of the most important pieces of California's coastal network. It's also, I think, a very important legal issue presented here that I'd like to call to your attention. First off, you know, this is both, as Ms. Jarabek has pointed out, a very important natural area and a very important cultural area. The portion of Tolowa Dunes State Park, which State Parks leadership is trying to reclassify, is designated as a historical district. That's why the Smith River Rancheria has come out strongly in opposition to this proposed reclassification. Those are the people descended from the people who are massacred in this area and who are buried in this area. And I think if you look at, if you take the time to look at the documents that State Parks staff has prepared for this, in support of this reclassification, you'll note that there's actually a very powerful set of arguments there for not decreased protection, but actually increased protection under the idea of a cultural preserve and a natural preserve. These areas are much more suitable for those kind of classifications than they are for the proposed state recreation area classification. The legal issue here, I think, is a critically important one. State Parks is asserting that past illegal hunting should be considered the baseline for consideration of the potential environmental effects. And they're basically asserting that because they've allowed an illegal action to happen for years in the past, that there would be no change in the intensity of use, triggering Coastal Commission review, CEQA, et cetera. I think it's pretty obvious from where I sit, and I hope from where you sit, that that principle is one that cannot be allowed to stand. If we are to allow illegal actions to form the backdrop and the basis for consideration of the legality of ongoing actions, we're basically giving a carte blanche to folks who don't take the law seriously. I thank you for your time and attention, and I urge you. Most people don't know Tahlua Dunes State Park. They don't understand the significance of the area. There is no place on the West Coast like it. It's very, very important. Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker is Laura Julian, followed by Richard Pedersen and Eileen Cooper.
Thank you for this chance to speak. My name is Laura Julian. I'm speaking on the issue of the proposed reclassification of Tahlua Dunes State Park to a state recreational area. I like to go out to Tahlua Dunes State Park and go out to Yantauket. I park my car at the end of Pala Road. I walk up the hill to the dune ridge above the area, right next to the Yantauket Cemetery. From there, you can look out to the Smith River or out to the Pacific Ocean. In winter, you can look back and see snow-covered Siskiyou Mountains. In the springtime, there's a big old apple tree out there that's just covered with blossoms and bees. In 1853, on a winter night, white militia from Crescent City came out to Yantauket, and they set fire to the lodges where Tahlua and Tatuni people were celebrating Nadesh. As the people emerged from the lodges, they shot them. A survivor of that night said that the slough, Yantauket slough, was red with blood, and there were bodies everywhere. State Parks is proposing to reclassify this area to allow hunting on Yantauket slough and to allow the sound of gunfire to be heard at Yantauket Cemetery 5 months of the year. America hasn't done the best job in remembering Native American massacres. We have over 312 Civil War battlefield national monuments. We only have three national monuments dedicated to Native American deaths. Of these three, at Wounded Knee, there were approximately 300 deaths. At Battle Creek, approximately 256. And at Sand Creek, over 150. Recent research by a doctoral candidate from Yale has demonstrated that that night at Yantauket, approximately 500 people died. State Parks has not done the best job in protecting this area. Last year, a body was dug up by pot hunters at the cemetery. I myself have reported pits in other areas dug in the area of Yantauket and Etchalet to State Parks. And State Parks has even instituted an outreach to the public to try and find people who will observe and protect people at this area because they have so few resources to do so. Basically, State Parks has failed in its mandate, both through the lack of protection of the area and proposing so insensitively to reclassify it for hunting. One of the criteria for proposing a national monument is that it not be previously or not be protected already. I didn't think that Yantauket Historic District qualified because it was under state park protection, but it's obvious from these actions and State Park's lack of concern and lack of funding that this area should be nominated as a national monument, and that rather than reclassifying it as a state recreational area, it should deserve to be a memory of what has happened at Yantauket. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Pedersen?
Hello, my name is Richard Pedersen. I'm from Crescent City.
Could you pull the microphone up, sir, so we can hear you?
And I advocate the preservation of Tahlua Dunes State Park. I've kind of been the eyes and ears on the ground looking at off-road vehicle abuse along the beaches and camera and GPS and several times a month. And every time I go out there, I find illegal off-roading going on. And a lot of this goes back into the interior part of the park, not just along the beaches, through the estuaries and along the lake shore and elsewhere, destroying the sensitive plants. And I'm concerned about the general degradation of the park. I think opening this area up for hunting, as the state parks director is proposing, will just increase the impacts. And so I'll keep my comments brief. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, sir. Eileen Cooper.
Hi, I'm Eileen Cooper. I'm on the board of the Friends of Del Norte, who strongly is on record opposing the reclassification of this park. I also participate as a volunteer. This is our Tallawa Dune Steward T-shirt, and there's a whole small little army of us in Del Norte that really loves this park. And it's really the Cinderella of the state park system. It's a gem that has yet to shine. The state park, I hear just recently, the state park budget for this park is $3,900. And they have assigned 1/7 of a ranger. And we were lucky to get even 1/7, I think. But there's this army of people up there that love it and think that the rare plants need to be protected and that the cultural resources are so outstanding that it deserves national monument status. And the idea that the state parks would not recognize this seems to go against their whole mission. And we just cannot believe what has been proposed. It's so unreasonable to us. No, thank you. We need your help to protect Cinderella. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's the last speaker, so if I have staff.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a couple of comments here. As I've indicated to this commission before, we have been very concerned about what's being proposed by State Park in terms of the reclassification. And to the best of our knowledge, this would be the first time in the history of California State Park system that a unit of the State Park is downgraded in terms of protection. That's an issue on policy. An issue in terms of the legal aspects, the legal issues, is whether or not a coastal permit, from our perspective, a coastal permit's required for this change in intensity of use. And our position over the years has been, and this is nothing new, that the hunting that took place there was illegal. It was illegal from the time that it was purchased until special legislation was passed between 1977 and 84. The hunting was illegal out there. It was legal after that only until the park was classified, which happened in 2001. And it was classified as a state park, which meant no hunting because of the level of protection. Well, it was allowed to continue. We reminded state parks that that was in violation of the Coastal Act. We were prepared to come forward to this commission with an enforcement action, and in fact, I talked to both the Director of Parks and Recreation and the Director of Fish and Game when the proposed transfer from State Parks was being proposed to Fish and Game and said that would require a Coastal Commission permit or review, actually a permit from the county first, which is appealable to this commission, and they dropped the proposal. And then this reclassification proposal came forward. And my contacts and my participation in a number of conversations and workshops indicates that virtually nobody in state parks supports this. We don't know why it's being pushed, but our issue really is the legal issue. The State Parks and Recreation Commission has scheduled a hearing on this. I believe it's October 8th. I plan to be there and, on behalf of the commission, remind the Parks Commission that this requires Coastal Commission review. And, in fact, as we speak, a letter should have been transmitted to the Director of Parks and Recreation, putting them on notice that it would be a violation of the Coastal Act to proceed with the reclassification without review by this Coastal Commission. So we will pass on that message. My hope is actually that it gets removed from the agenda and the whole idea gets dropped, because it is leading to a confrontation between two state agencies that we don't need. We've been working very cooperatively with the department and so many other areas of the state. Unfortunately, Tallawa Dunes State Park is one of those areas that's been neglected. We have a violation letter out to the department on the illegal use of off-highway vehicles in the park. They indicate that they don't have the resources to enforce the law. That, from our perspective, the fact that they have put so many resources into this attempt to reclassify says to us they do have some resources, obviously. They're just not spending it the right way. And the right way is to prepare a general plan. There is no general plan for this park. The commission has gone on record on a number of occasions saying you need to prepare a general plan. And this idea of relying on illegal hunting over the last many years to say there's no change in use, as one of the speakers pointed out, defies logic and certainly defies the law. So I wanted to put this on the record, because that hearing is coming up between this your meeting today and your next meeting. We'll report to you on the status of what happened at your October meeting in Oceanside.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Bloom?
A quick question. If, in fact, a next appropriate step would be, would it be for state parks to prepare the general plan?
That's correct.
What mechanisms does the Coastal Commission have to influence that to move forward?
We have urged the department to complete a general plan as required by state law. So, for example, the use of vehicles on the beach, the wave slope, street-legal vehicles. From our perspective, that's illegal because there is no general plan. We've been urging them for years to prepare a general plan, and the answer we keep getting back is we don't have the resources. And, of course, the Coastal Commission doesn't have the resources.
Let me ask a little bit differently. If this were in private hands and the equivalent of or a general plan were to be required or something like that, and there were to be no evidence of action being taken, what would the commission normally do?
Well, we have a much stronger enforcement capability when we're talking about non-governmental agencies, especially governmental agencies that are represented by the Attorney General, because as you know, as in Oceana Dunes and a few other instances where we are in conflict with another state agency represented by the Attorney General, we can't proceed with an enforcement action that requires legal action and be represented by the Attorney General.
We would have to hire outside counsel.
That's correct, and that's very challenging for us. Plus, it's been the policy of this commission to try to work out conflicts with other agencies in a mutually acceptable way so that we don't waste public resources fighting each other over issues that we should be cooperatively working to resolve.
Well, I understand that, but maybe one of the reasons that this isn't moving towards a satisfactory resolution is that the other agency is aware that we don't have enough tools in our toolbox. I mean, sometimes having the ability to litigate or being able to at least make that case to another party goes a long way to influencing things to move forward to resolution. So I guess the only thing I can ask at this point is that the commission staff try to think creatively how we can bring this issue to a more satisfactory conclusion.
We have, and I don't want to talk about some of those options that we have, but we are doing that. And with your help, we're doing that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we'll actually, public comment time has passed, so we're going to go ahead and go to the regular agenda. Charles, did you have something we needed to address from yesterday?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yesterday we trailed item W6A, an administrative permit for Energy and Ocean Resources, because of a noticing error on the item. So we opened the hearing yesterday and continued it today. So I'd like to finish reporting on that item today.
All right.
It is an administrative permit and after the fact authorization for the removal of three crude oil pipelines from a wetland area within Los Cerritos Wetland Complex, and also the construction of a replacement pipeline outside of the wetland. We've conditioned the permit to address any potential impacts to wetlands and would request that the commission concur with the ED's determination for this administrative permit.
Any objection to concurrence? Seeing none, the commission concurs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on then, that brings us to the Deputy Director's Report for the North Coast District. And there are some handouts. We distributed a packet yesterday, and then there's some additional letters that came in this morning. The packet contained a green addendum with 16 letters regarding item 8B, which is the application of City of Eureka and BLM for reauthorizing OHV riding on the Samoa Peninsula. There's also a letter on the Crescent City LCP update amendment, item 6A, in that packet. There were three letters distributed this morning, two with regard to the OHV issue and one with regard to item 6A from the City of Crescent City regarding the LCP update. There's also a pink addendum that was distributed, and that pink addendum, the district director's report, contains a total of four permit waivers and two immaterial permit amendments, and we're aware of no opposition to those items, and we recommend that the commission concur with the executive director's determination to grant the waivers and the immaterial amendment.
Thank you, staff. Any objection to concurrence from commissioners? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
That brings us to the consent calendar, item 5. And as I mentioned at the start of the meeting, there are two items that have been moved to the consent calendar, and those include item 8A, the application of DIAS, and item 9A, which is the permit amendment request from Humboldt County Public Works. And for the benefit of anyone in the audience who may be present to hear these items or speak on those items, by moving them to consent, the items will be heard as part of the consent calendar, where the issue will be limited to whether they should remain on the consent calendar. Should the commission decide to remove them from the consent calendar, they'll revert to their regular place on the agenda for a hearing on the merits. The two applications involve DIAS. This is a merger and re-subdivision of two parcels totaling 33 acres that would be divided into 13 lots ranging in size from 1 1/4 to 4.5 acres each, which is located off of Mitchell Heights Drive on the south side of Myrtle Avenue, about a mile east of Eureka. Only a small portion of the site is in the commission's jurisdiction. We have recommended conditions that would require that small portion, which contains riparian ESHA, be reserved for open space. And we believe with that condition, it's consistent with the Coastal Act. The second project, the Humboldt County Public Works project, involves an amendment to a permit granted in 2008 to allow the county to do sedimentation removal of a right-of-way underneath the old Arcata Road bridge over Jacoby Creek. And the amendment would modify the process. The original permit, as proposed, it indicated no dredging within the channel itself. The amendment would allow that, but would require diversion of the stream and fish capture and relocation in order to avoid impacts to the sensitive fish species that occupy the channel. The project's supported by Fish and Game, and the conditions in the staff report are in line with the recommendations of NOAA Fisheries, who reviewed this. So we're aware of no opposition to either of these applications, and we recommend that upon the close of the consent calendar hearing that you approve them with the recommended conditions and findings listed in the staff reports.
Thank you, staff. Are there any ex parte communications on the consent calendar items 8A and 9A? Seeing none, the pleasure of the commission.
Move approval.
We have a motion by Commissioner Sanchez, a second by Commissioner Secord. Maker and seconder recommending a yes vote. Would you like to speak to the motion, Commissioner Secord? All right. Any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the items are approved.
Okay. That brings us to item 6A, which is the City of Crescent City LCP amendment. And the item is actually an update of the LCP that was certified in the mid-80s, and the published staff recommendation recommends certification with numerous suggested modifications. But today we are recommending that after opening the public hearing and taking testimony that you continue the matter to the October agenda. The city has requested more time to be able to review the suggested modifications, and we believe that additional time would be beneficial both for the city and for staff to consider those changes, consider any input that you may have today, so that we can incorporate them into a revised staff report for the October agenda. But we do feel it's very important to allow for the public comment today while we're in the local area, and so that we can fully receive the input that people would like to offer. Presenting the staff recommendation today is North Coast analyst Jim Baskin, who has been working extremely hard on this LCP update, and I'd like to commend him for that, and I'll turn it over to Jim.
All right. Thank you. Welcome, Jim.
Morning, commissioners. Well, as Bob indicated, what I'd like to do is similar to what we did last year for the Delaware County update, and then take this time at this hearing date to just basically give you an overview of the city, some of its resources and setting, and give you a general orientation to its layout, the coastal zone portions, that is, and then enumerate what has and are some of the major suggested modifications in our recommendation on this. And then finally, just to identify some of the substantial issues that have come up as matters of concern for the city in terms of what we, are, as staff, are recommending. Okay. Next slide, please. Crescent City is on the Smith River Crescent City coastal plain that runs from the area of the Mad River, I'm sorry, the Smith River down to the headlands to the south of the area. Just a little bit on setting there. Next, please. The coastal zone boundary is coterminous with the city's municipal boundary as it intersects the coastline, starting at the Preston Rock area there in the middle left of the slide, and then wrapping around in a somewhat counterclockwise direction down toward the Crescent City Harbor, the frontage lands around the harbor. And then the southern city limit boundary is roughly about halfway in the middle of the crescent of the harbor there. So that effectively is the coastal zone portion. Because it was mainly urbanized at the time of the Coastal Act passing, the coastal zone is actually rather narrow through this area, essentially 1 to 3 blocks in width as it wraps around the ocean shoreline and the bay shoreline of the city. Next slide, please. Founded in the mid-1850s, Crescent City started out initially as a port of supply for the mines in the interior, the Trinity Mountain gold fields and what have you. Later that diversified into the typical resource extraction industries that were based in the area, including timber and later fishing. Next, please. Crescent City also has, as part of its legacy, somewhat of a natural disaster infamy as well. mainly for a number of reasons. Its bathymetry and location on the Pacific Rim, it tends to be somewhat of a focal point for the energy from earthquake events around the Pacific Rim. This shot is from the 1960 Chilean earthquake and the ensuing wave that came into the harbor at that particular time. Next slide. Perhaps more notorious is the aftermath of the 1964 Anchorage earthquake, which destroyed on the order of something about 9 blocks into town. There were, I believe, 12 lives that were lost at that particular time. Next slide. This is a graphic that shows essentially the inundation area from that 1964 event that went well up the Elk River lower estuary and watershed and wrapping in and around the lower portions of the town. The graphic actually has it's rather cartoonish, but actually shows that the fuel depot at that point was on fire there in this area right here, burned for a number of days. Next slide, please. And more recently, in the Kuril Island earthquakes that happened in 2005, another wave came in. This wave was, I believe, only on the order of 4 to 5 feet in height, but it still did multi-million dollar damage within the facilities of the Crescent City Harbor itself. Next slide, please. Now, if I can just kind of give you an orientation to the planning area, starting again at the northwest side of the town, the coastal zone portion of the city commences with the Preston Rock Coastal Access Area. There's a road down, some informal parking at the base, and this was at one time an offshore headland that has effectively been mined down, essentially to grade for the material that formed the jetties of the harbor. Next, please. Continuing south, the coastline is a low bluff, roughly about 40 to 50 feet in height. We're passing now by one of the sites that is the subject of the specific redesignations that's being proposed by the city, the so-called Grinnell site. It actually is a private parcel there in the middle of the slide on the ocean side, roughly about 20 to 30 feet in width. At the street side, and then quickly going down to the shoreline. That's being proposed to be taken from a open space designation and put into a single-family residential zoning. A land use plan designation to match the zoning that had actually been certified for it in 1983. Next slide, please. Continuing on down to the south, you may see a couple of project sites. Some of the commissioners may recall or are familiar with. This would be the Hampton Inn development that came in 2001, and to its left is the Costa Norte condominium project site that's presently still developed with the former medical clinic offices. That went through a rezone, and you may recall that last year that was a subject of the unveiling of some of the new policies of the commissions with regard to tsunami building resiliency, minimum floor height standards, and what have you for withstanding tsunami risks. Next slide, please. As you wrap around the horn, if you will, which is the Battery Point Lighthouse that's there just off the bottom of the frame, you get to what is the Battery Point Recreation Area that's referred to in the staff materials. This area is primarily an open space designation. However, as you get more to the right side and over toward the wastewater treatment plant and what have you, to the harbor side of that is where you start getting into the Battery Point Recreation Area that's zoned for zoned and planned for harbor-related uses. That's somewhat of a remnant of a project that was envisioned in the city to put in some private and public recreational facilities at one time that never has really come to pass. Next slide, please. This is a blow-up of that area, the B Street Pier that projects into the north side of the harbor, as well as the outer breakwater of the harbor itself. And in the mid-distance there, one of the large city park areas within town, Beachfront Park. Over on the upper right, you can see the estuary of the Elk Creek area that's coming down there. Next slide, please. In the lower left, right next to the wastewater treatment facilities, is a small area that is being proposed to be expanded into, right in this general area down in there, that is presently in a open space designation, and staff is suggesting in this particular case it remain in open space instead of being going to expand it into harbor related as is being proposed by the city. Next slide, please. And as we make our way over toward the Elk Creek area, beachfront park on the left, and we start getting into the inner harbor reaches, which is the second area mainly of rezoning intensity that's being proposed. Next slide, please. The area along the inner shore of the harbor is a combination of an RV park that is owned and operated by the city, as well as some vacant lands that wrap around before actually getting into the working portion of the harbor. This area is the largest concentration of the city's harbor-related zoning, envisioned primarily as support area for the working harbor and the harbor-dependent uses that are located therein. It is roughly about 30 acres in size in total. Much of it is being proposed to be redesignated out of harbor-related into a combination of other designations, many of them for other priority uses, such as the RV park, into a visitor-serving commercial designation. But other areas have been contemplated for other types of uses and development, such as condominiums on this interceding parcel here. There are wetlands that have been delineated in this area, and more to the point of the priority protections, that with such a large percentage of this area being proposed to go to another designation, this would leave very, very little area, mainly this one remaining parcel, as in harbor-related designation. So that's another area where staff is concerned that there's not adequate basis that's been established right now for those redesignations to the highest priority uses. Next slide, please. And this is finally the other portion of the harbor area before we get to the city boundary right here at the start of the Crescent City Harbor. So if we can go to the next slide. A final portion of the town is on the inland side of 101. This is mainly developed with a row of hotels and restaurants and whatnot. And it would be going from a designation that would now be highway service to match essentially the development pattern in that area. It's essentially a two-block wide area or deep area, and the rear portion of it is made up of wetlands that have since 1983, when the LCP was first certified, have been purchased by the Department of Fish and Game. Next slide, please. I just wanted to quickly go through some of the reclassifications where staff is making various recommendations. This is the Grinnell parcel being proposed to be, as I mentioned, changed from open space to a residential designation. We are, staff are recommending that it actually stay in its current configuration, given the lack of information to suggest that it could be developed in a manner that would not significantly affect coastal resources. Next slide, please. Again, the area around the ocean front where there's recommendations with regard generally supporting this reclassification to a visitor-serving commercial land use designation and associated zoning, mainly to extinguish the old, outdated medical-related designations from that remain from it, the days of its being the county hospital site. Next, please. Again, the Battery Point area and the harbor-related, which is being proposed to be expanded, that would be recommended to be essentially maintained as open space in a small portion. Next, please. Then we get over to the harbor area again, where those designations are again going from harbor related to open space and various other designations. Next, please. And then one more of the harbor parcel again. Next, please. I'd finally like to get to a list of what have been identified in our review as the significant suggested modifications that have been made. Much of the suggested mods take the form of either of updating to contemporary standards and practices, and these include such things as getting contemporary standards in the LCP for processes for accepting and the dedication of public access dedications, recognition of the California Coastal Trail through the city. In the ESHA chapters, there are now new provisions being suggested for the conducting of biological assessments, wetlands delineations, and also the expansion of buffers around ESHA throughout the city. Currently, the city only has a 50-foot standard around wetlands. We are recommending that a default 100-foot standard be established around all ESHAs with provisions for site-specific reviews and adjustment as may be needed. Water quality best management practices to reflect the standards that have been developed over this last decade in concert with the regional boards. New standards with regard to geotechnical coastal flooding analyses, including the tsunami resiliency, building design, and sea level rise calculation accommodations, and protection of sites for priority uses, as was mentioned, the concern being the redesignation of the harbor-related areas. The other areas of the suggested mods mainly cover bringing it into compliance with Coastal Act and other state laws, the LCP, with regard to its public hearing and notice requirements, the ministerial provisions for approval of secondary residential units, the awarding of density bonuses, and also recommendations with regard to what has now become dated provisions for wind generation systems on private parcels, which would need to be revisited. Next, please. We, as Bob may have indicated, have met with the city and had some initial discussions with their staff with regard to what's being recommended, and have identified two areas from those discussions which we believe are of controversy to the city. The first being restrictions on the diversification of the harbor area. And I believe distributed to you this morning was a material from the city with regard to this and the other issues that are following. The next slide, please. Again, the overall harbor and the sitting of the city are pretty much hand in glove here. Even though the harbor itself, it's the working portions of it are outside the city, it is in direct adjacency to it. And our feeling was that there just was, at this point, not enough adequate information to really substantiate the redesignation of large areas within the city away from those harbor-related and harbor-supportive roles until that data gets developed. Next, please. The second area of controversy is relating to the elevated response to global sea level rise and tsunami hazards that we have included in a number of modifications. These include such things as the inundation minimum floor heights for new residential, permanent residential structures that are arising out of subdivisions, building resiliency standards with regard to wave strike, and factoring in projected sea level rise into these various evaluations. Much of what has been observed by the county last year is being revisited along that subject line again for this particular LCP. The same concerns having to do with whether or not there's adequate basis to begin factoring these in as a baseline analysis for these types of studies. Next slide, please. And that pretty much concludes what I had for you this morning. I would, as Bob suggested, I would suggest that we take what testimony there may be from the public on this item. And as always, if you have any questions, I'd be welcome to entertain them.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
We do have three speakers, I believe. Two from the city and one from Friends of the Dunes. So I'd like to welcome up the City of Crescent City speakers, Gary Pedroni and Eric Taylor. And I'm not sure who wants to go first and how much time you'd like. Good morning.
Morning. Thank you. I'm Gary Pedroni, and I don't need too much time, maybe 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, we'll give you five.
Okay, that'll be plenty. I'm working as a contract planner with the city, and I've worked with the Coastal Commission elsewhere in the state, so it's good to be back. Sorry, I did have to bring some information today, which Jim mentioned. It's a memo from the city with today's date. It's 3 pages long, and it does address the same things that were in your staff report. There were kind of 3 main areas of contention that we had, and Jim went over it. Probably the most serious one relates to the harbor-related discussion that we were having. I guess there's 2 ways to approach it. The city intended to leave some land designated harbor-related, but expand what you could do within that designation to include some commercial and some residential as secondary uses. And the staff is recommending that the harbor-related remain fairly restrictive, at least restrictive in the city's position, which would exclude those uses. Kind of the second approach would be to reclassify some of the harbor-related to other uses like highway services that would allow what the city wanted to do. There are people in the city that are interested in developing some of these properties, and the city's of the opinion that the mixed use and would bring economic vitality and would actually, you know, support the harbor in that way, maybe not directly in, as far as what was intended in the original harbor-related language. Let's see. And thirdly, just to reiterate, it's the requirements with the tsunami run-up and the flooding. On some of these lower-lying parcels, it does create a situation where the building's going to be perched up 17 or 20 feet high, you know, on poles, and that might be an extreme example, but there are a few properties that would be in that situation. And that's so we would probably like to revisit that, but as Jim was mentioning, that's probably still evolving also. And finally, there were just 2 other items that weren't really mentioned in the staff report. I think Jim mentioned them briefly. The ESHA setback at going from 50 to 100 feet as sort of the standard. You know, being a city, a lot of the parcels are fairly small. There's just the concern that that would remove, you know, the development potential from a parcel. I do believe the Coastal Act protects against a taking, so I think in that kind of case, I guess that's the city's concern, is that the ESHA setback wouldn't wipe out the development potential of a parcel. So we're just raising it as a matter of discussion. And one last one. It would be kind of new to the city, but there's quite a bit of visual analysis proposed. I think it's might be fairly standard for some places as far as aesthetics and review. They'll be fairly new to the city of Crescent City, so it's just kind of raised as an issue for their kind of flag for their city council because of the layers review that would be required, which would be new to them. So really that's all I had to say, and I think we're going to hopefully have a chance to meet with the staff again before the October meeting. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Eric Taylor? How much time did you need, sir?
About 30 minutes. No, 5 minutes would be fine. You'd be sick of listening to me by then. But I'll build upon a few of these issues again.
Could you state your name for the record?
Eric Taylor, City Crescent City. I'm the associate planner. Our main concern really is, the conversion from the harbor-related to the highway services already mentioned. And also, when you combine that with the tsunami inundation and sea level rise, for that south part of our Highway 101 corridor, it is very restrictive. It almost makes it impossible for some people to develop property down there. If you look at the city, it's about 1.6 square miles in total. The city was primarily built on the logging industry. Just give you a little perspective, at one time there were 20 mills operating in Delmar County. Today there are none. Economically, we have not recovered from that. As a result, we've pretty much converted mostly to a tourism-based economy, and a big portion of that is that Highway 101 corridor and that visitor-serving portion of that, which half of that falls within the coastal zone. So to put these restrictions on us and not allowing us, one, if you look at the harbor-related uses right now, it's so restrictive. You can have, I believe it's boat building facilities, net building, wharfs, and fuel storage, which, I mean, probably in decades we haven't had any of those uses down there. So I would suggest that really, if you look at the economic trend over the past few decades, it suggests the opposite, that there's really no need for basically 20 acres of harbor-related zoning down there along that corridor. I just hope that the biggest thing I just want to get across is economically our town could really ill afford not to be able to develop this and to build upon the tourism-based economy that we have. And if you look at the restrictions that are proposed, that Gary had already mentioned, I can't envision anybody coming building, say, a 65-unit hotel on stilts. I mean, the cost would just be prohibitive. Nobody's going to do it, a restaurant or any other type of facility for that matter. So, again, we'll be readdressing this with staff, and hopefully we'll be able to work this out. And I know initially when this was proposed for the condominium project that came in last year, the argument at that time was that they were more concerned with full-time residential units because people basically have most, you know, their biggest investment in their homes. And that's understandable, but I think if you look the way the language is written now, I think it's human-occupied structures. So now we're talking about basically putting this on every single commercial or any structure built in the city. It's really prohibitive, and it could actually have some serious economic effect on our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Ellen Cooper?
Hi. Eileen Cooper, with the Friends of Del Norte. We handed in a brief one-page addendum, and we're very glad to see the clarification about wetland buffers as a standard, and of course always to accommodate development that can be reduced. So we feel that the being consistent with some of the small sensitive areas that Crescent City encompasses, it's important to have the 100-foot buffer for wetlands. Elk Creek is an outstanding resource that comes into the harbor area. It's lush, beautiful, highly biologically valuable, and it needs the 100-foot buffers. The issue about what kind of development goes in the harbor, we stay out of to a point because we are a resource-oriented group. However, having safe development is an ecological issue in that we don't want, we want to minimize the damaging effects that can happen in the aftermath of a tsunami to a community, the cleanup necessary, the pollution and all that. When I was talking to Laura Bommelin, the local Tallawa historian, Native American historian, I asked, well, I know you had a village up on Point St. George, up on the cliff, and up in Smith River, but what about where Crescent City is, right here? And he said, oh, no, the Tallawa would never build there. That is not a safe place. We would never put a village there. So if we are going to have development, certainly places where this inundation is very likely to occur need the strongest of standards to protect health, welfare of human beings and the environment. And we stand strongly behind that staff recommendation. And Our list is short. We want the beautiful Esha area in front of the waste treatment plant to remain beautiful. Little Riparian Cove and Tidal Flat area and Elk Creek to remain beautiful. We thank staff very much for the hard work and for the Coastal Commission's final attention to Crescent City LCP. And we see one thing that I was looking at as potential uses for harbor-related is our Pacific North. Okay, well, we are the on a global rating, we have the greatest potential for wave energy.
So that's it.
All right. Thank you. And that's our last speaker on this item 6A. And our intent is to continue it to the October meeting. Staff, did you have anything else? I know commissioners have some questions and comments.
I do just have a few comments in response to some of the issues that were raised in the testimony. As the city staff and Jim had identified, the largest issue is the expansion of allowable uses in the harbor-related area, and in fact some conversion of harbor-related to visitor-serving uses. And there's no doubt that the harbor is not as vibrant as perhaps it was in the past or as it had been envisioned under the original LCP, but our concern is that to allow those lands to be converted to other uses before there's been a sort of long-range evaluation of what the demand is for harbor-related land in that harbor, what are the most important sites to retain if there is going to be some reduction, that it would be premature to include the numbers of changes that are proposed. And you'll notice in the staff report, there's one particular site that is does not have frontage on the water and does have frontage on the highway, where are recommending that a site-specific change to another use be allowed. Its utility for harbor seems to be a lot less than other places. But before large-scale changes would occur, we're concerned that there hasn't been the analysis. With regard to the tsunami issue, it is the staff recommendation that tsunami hazards be addressed more thoroughly. One of the requirements that was also applied in the Costa Norte project is that the floor level of residential development be placed above the tsunami wave run-up with a one-foot freeboard on top of that. That's actually the recommendation here as well. There wouldn't be a requirement that the floor area of non-residential development be similarly positioned at that height, although all development would still have to go out, the analysis of the structural integrity and development would still need to be judged to be safe to be approved. So that's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Juan?
I move that we continue this to the October hearing.
We have a motion by Commissioner Juan, a second by Commissioner Schallenberger. Would you like to speak to that motion?
Well, I do want to speak and address some of the issues, but I think we ought to take a vote on this, and then I'll provide you with my list of comments.
All right. Any objection to a unanimous roll call vote on the continuance? Seeing none, the item is continued till October. Commissioner Juan?
Okay. Please bear with me, because in going through this, I have quite a few comments, some of them major, some of them not. I think that on the harbor issues, and the change in zoning, the staff has got it right. I understand the city has a desire for some greater diversity, but allowing these changes of uses could eventually impact the function of the harbor itself, and I think that's my concern. And I think staff's approach to doing it at this point, at least on a sort of a case-by-case basis and looking at each one, is important. But harbors are very important to this state's and nation's commerce, and if you allow certain developments, and I'm very much in favor of visitor serving, but there's a place for them, and the reason that harbors, you want harbor hotels and residences can actually affect the function of the harbor eventually, and what you don't want to have happen is to use up some of this area for these non-harbor related uses, and then later in the future, there'll be a need to dig another harbor someplace. And that, when you dig a new harbor, that has tremendous impacts. And I realize that the fishing industry is on decline and will probably continue to be on decline, but the shipping industry is not. That is going to continue to increase. And so to have harbor land needs to be saved for harbor purposes, and I think that's what's specified in the Coastal Act. And obviously, our standard of review is the Coastal Act. Just a couple of minor issues on the harbor that I would like to see. This is kind of a nitpicky thing, but when you're talking about boating and recreational boating, you should have a statement in there that says including non-motorized watercraft, because there's a big move meant on people to have, you know, kayaks and other human-powered watercraft in the recreational boating category. So I don't want it to be accidentally omitted. then on the sea level rise issue and the tsunami issue, I'm sort of amazed at the resistance to including these protections. This is the most likely place in the country to have this happen, okay, because this is the place where it's happened in the past. And then to say that somehow it's too expensive to put these in, we're talking about public safety. There are going to be innocent people years from now when a tsunami hits that could lose their lives. To say that you can't put it in because it might be too expensive is like saying, well, we can't put in fire doors in a hotel because it might be too expensive. If you can't build a building that is safe enough to guarantee, to at least provide reasonable protection for human life, then you shouldn't be allowed to build it. I mean, this is something that the building industry faces all the time. I understand the economics, and I understand why they fight them, but they fight most of these regulations, and I think it's time to understand that tsunamis are a very real threat, and my guess is, given global change and climate change, we're going to face that as an increasing threat, not decreasing. So I think staff certainly has got it correct. Next issue, as you can expect, would be the habitat issues for me. I think the 100-foot buffer is critical. There, frankly, are lots of important habitat areas in this region. And the 100-foot buffer doesn't mean it can't be reduced. And by the way, the takings issue is not a real issue, because clearly if there's a takings, that's a basis for a reduction in a buffer. My concern about what I see in the staff report and the staff recommendations is that there's no minimum buffer. And I'm going to remind staff that when I think it was the Del Norte we were doing, and I brought this issue up, and you said, no problem, you know, we don't really have to be concerned about that. It must have been only 2 or 3 weeks later that I got a phone call saying, oh, they're planning on reducing a buffer to 5 feet, and will you appeal this project? And I said, oh, that's why I thought there ought to be a minimum. You can have a minimum, and even with a minimum, if there's a takings issue, it will override that. So I think you do need to include a minimum. I have a couple of language changes, and I don't know if you want me to give you those now, but or I can give them to you. But, for example, on 1.A, page 36, it says, in this division, coastal-dependent developments shall not be sited in a wetland. I think that needs to be in a wetland or ESHA, because wetland is a very specific type of ESHA. But it's not general enough. And you've got the same thing on page 48 under harbor development, 1.E.2. On page 132 in the IP, it talks about requiring an analysis of unauthorized development, including grading or vegetation removal, that may have contributed to the degradation of elimination of the habitat area or species that would otherwise be present on the site in a healthy condition. That's fine, but it doesn't specify that if the unauthorized vegetation removal resulted in the loss of ESHA, that the site shall be considered to be ESHA, as if it hadn't happened. Kind of reminds me of the Talawa Dunes issue. Okay, you go in and you do it illegally, and then you get to say it's not there. Okay, there are a couple of other major areas. Visitor-serving uses. I think it's interesting to note that the definition of a motel in the LUP defines a motel as allowing up to 50% of the motel to be apartments. I'm not sure I understand how an apartment is part of anything that's visitor serving. Apartments are basically full-time residential, so I think you need to take a look at that. I think you also need to take a look at the way you're dealing with timeshares and condo hotels. You're allowing up to 50%, which is and I'm assuming this is also on new hotels. We've been treating new hotels and conversion of existing hotels differently. We have not, in general, been allowing up to 50%. That's pretty high. And I think Commissioner Crew and I were talking about it. He says it's like 20-30% in general. But the biggest thing is that there's a lack of a lot of conditions on how these units should be used. You do specify a time limit that they can be, time restrictions. But what you don't do is have the various conditions that we have in other LCPs and other permits in which we make sure that they are actually going to be run as hotels and not as residential units. And particularly if you have a high enough percentage of the rooms in private ownership, you're going to face that that issue. I also, this is just a question, and I don't have a particular position on it, but you use the statewide average to determine what is lower cost visitor serving. And I'm not sure that in this area where hotel rates are considerably lower than the state average, that using the state average is appropriate rather than using the local average. In general, you're correct, but now you're comparing it to a state average that includes Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, and I don't think that that's comparable to Crescent City. Probably a nice reason for why Crescent City is such a nice place to live. you have a section on small wind turbines. But nothing in there to deal with the impacts the commission has been concerned about, which is the impacts to birds and bats and how to avoid them. We dealt with this in Santa Cruz and we denied one. I suggest that you look at the CEC guidelines for these, the fish and game, see if there are some guidelines that can be put in. I understand that there are some ordinances in places like San Diego and Marin and Sonoma that you might want to look at that deal with some of the issues surrounding small wind turbines. You don't want to necessarily deny them, but you need to deal with height and number of turbines and the type of turbine and the noise and various land use issues and, as I said, the impact to birds and bats. So I think we need to have some guidelines in there for the city when they are approving these. And then views. Sorry, folks, but protecting views is important under the Coastal Act. And the fact that Crescent City hasn't dealt with this in the past doesn't mean that it's not appropriate to deal with it. You have conditions in the LCP that require that you can't have lot splits unless the land division can be shown to be able to be developed, say, from geologic hazards and from ashes in their buffers, but not from views. In other words, if you're going to split a lot, you have to make sure that you can split it without having an adverse impact on coastal resources in general, and views are a coastal resource. In the harbor-related zone, development is allowed to 50 feet. Are there any conditions on view impacts? Is that something that has to be considered? I don't know. I couldn't figure it out, but you can look at
it. My understanding is there aren't specific provisions dealing with the harbor.
And I have just a couple of other things on public access. I agree that we do always balance the rights of property owners against the need for public access, but there are some statements in here that are written in such a way that are so absolute about must protect the private property rights without saying at the same time that you need to balance it. I think you need to take a look to see what the implications are. Because there's no qualification in a couple of instances, and I can give you the specific citations. And this is something that always concerns me, and I don't know whether or not you want to deal with it, but there's a provision on public access that says if the city is unable to open, operate, and maintain the access way, the city shall have the right to transfer the easement to a non-profit association. I'd like to see, because from experiences up and down the coast, that if the city doesn't open it, that in fact they should give it to a nonprofit or to another agency, because sometimes cities find themselves or local jurisdictions find themselves in a situation where a local property owner doesn't want the access way opened, and it becomes politically problematic for the city to actually open it. And if they can transfer it back, that actually gets them out from under that, and it's obviously something we should desire, particularly on a vertical easement, because we want those things to be opened. So those are my comments and suggestions.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to appreciate the comments and appreciate also if you could send us the specific list that you had. I'd very much appreciate that.
Right. And Commissioner Bloom?
I just wanted to weigh in and excuse me, say that I think staff's suggestion that long-range planning take place is an important one. I'm not clear to the what the extent of that planning has been to this point in Crescent City, but if we can encourage that to happen and then look at some of these issues again in the future, I think that would be very helpful to everyone. In particular, I'm hearing arguments made which I think make a lot of sense to me about the economic circumstances that could be a bar to certain types of development. And I think having an analysis that backs that up in some way is particularly important. With respect to the issue of tsunamis, obviously this is an important issue. But I think there's a balance, and I'm not pretending to know where that line ought to be drawn between providing the maximum amount of protection and balancing that against the other indirect and direct impacts that building to that level and planning to that level can create. So if we think about, I mean, some of the things that I'm hearing, like houses on stilts, are perhaps structural changes that need to be made in order to withstand tsunamis, may in fact have other economic consequences that also affect the health of a community. So if these standards were to be so prohibitive that nothing happens in this community, And I don't, unfortunately, know enough about the economic circumstances of Crescent City to really state a view on this. But if we have areas in the state, just to think about it broadly, that are not economically viable, that are not doing well, that affects the health of the community, and that has its own consequences. It is also economically successful communities that are able to address other issues that are important to this commission, environmental issues that are important to this commission. I mean, I can point to my own city as being fortunate enough to be very economically successful, and we're able to address a whole range of environmental concerns that other communities are simply not able to do. So again, I think that there are some important balances that we need to be thinking about. On the other end of things, if it is so expensive to, it may be in fact possible to build some of these things to the standards that we're talking about, but if the impact of that is that the only businesses or individuals who are able to locate there are in the higher economic categories, then we're creating another impact that is not something that this commission wants to encourage. So I think we need to be thinking about all of these things, what came to mind during the discussion that we've been having is we certainly could in the automobile industry we understand that there are many accidents that occur that could be prevented injuries and property damage and lives lost that could be prevented if we built cars to a much higher standard. But many times it is important for us to implement and for government to influence what those standards are. But if you build those standards so high that it makes the cost of the product unaffordable, then you're having an impact that is not one that's desired. So not saying that those types of things shouldn't be built in, but we do need to think about the consequences on a broader level, I think.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Sanchez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to first say that I join with Commissioner Juan on her comments, and thank you very much for the deep analysis, Commissioner Juan. I also feel very strongly about maintaining the harbor uses, the Coastal Act, as well as the Department of Boating and Waterways, another state department. Very strong language about maintaining these uses, and residential is always a lower desirable use. I see that the possibilities of expanding harbor uses, water uses. I also see that in terms of looking at the economic viability, this is not going to stay this way for this area. As it becomes more and more pricey to live in, for example, the southern coastal areas, San Diego County, I can take as an example, people are being moved out of places that they love and have learned to love, and you are going to be getting people coming to Northern California, to places that have harbors, to want to live near so that they can continue to enjoy that way of life. Whenever you talk to people who are very committed to living near a harbor and that way of life, it's something that is just very special to the coast in California. The fact that we have these protections is something that protects us in terms of the longer term. So I do agree with staff in terms of the maintaining the harbor uses and the protection of the eshes. I also agree we need to have a minimum. I don't know if that would be 50 feet for the 100-foot buffer. It is our responsibility to plan for public safety issues. I don't see how we can escape that. That must fall within our jurisdiction. We are here as a state commission that must consider these things. So I don't see. I agree with staff that these need to be studied very well, and there needs to be a critical analysis of these issues, especially since there is a history in this area. So I look forward to October's meeting, and hopefully staff will be able to have these kind of discussions with the applicant and come up with something that could be very good for Crescent City. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Kruer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to address the safety issue, and I'd like to put my developer hat on instead of my Coastal Commission hat. I think it's really essential that if in an area like this where there's been previous issues with the tsunami in one of the biggest problems in the state for tsunamis or an area for this, I think as a developer you would be remiss or a city not to have a review of this. I would never do that, and the reason is that the potential long-term liability as the seller, the property owner, etc., when you have constructive knowledge of something that's happened in the past, I think it would be irresponsible of the owner not to have those studies and make sure. And if it is something that's a deal killer, it's a deal killer. But at least you've addressed the safety issues and have made sure that as a responsible owner that you have evaluated, looked into this, et cetera. And you, economic things never trump safety, and they shouldn't do that. So as a developer, I think you really want to have a city have you review that and make sure, because that is a safety check and a step in the way that takes care of a lot of issues long term. And that's just the way I feel on the tsunami thing. I think it's really something that both the city and any potential developer or lender or anybody's going to want to see in this area, but that's just my input on it. Now, let me address the economic issues. To me, the area of the harbor is, I think Commissioner Juan and Commissioner Sanchez appropriately suggested, a harbor is a harbor, and once it's gone, it's gone. And to build a new harbor obviously makes great challenges and large environmental hurdles and approvals, et cetera. And what you don't want to do is, because of economic times, which everybody faces throughout the state, is allow a backdoor way of creating harbor uses into residential uses because you think you can create some more income. Well, that income with residential is very short term, and it creates some impacts that go with it. So it's really kind of not the smartest way to go. So you've got to be very careful in that. Now, as far as timeshares and condo conversions or condo hotels, et cetera, we've had a long debate and discussion and with staff and the commission, and we've looked at this. But typically 50% is not a and I hate to use percentages because the economic way when you review these analyses, it's not to trump the Coastal Act with economic reasons. It's to look at it to see, is this a small project, for example? The devil's always in the detail and say, this is only 8 units, and they want to make half of them a condo hotel or something like that. Well, you know right away when you do any analysis, they're not going to have the money to manage that and preserve that zoning of that visitor-serving condo hotel long-term. So, again, that's why you do the economic analysis. And it has helped people when the commission has allowed 20 or 25% in the last few years, et cetera, helped them to get a higher value from their lender or something when they go to get a construction loan, et cetera, because you have a mixed use and help subsidize, maybe build affordable units where necessarily they wouldn't have been built. But we all have a responsibility. The city has a responsibility. We at the Coastal Commission have a responsibility. On these things, it's the devil's in the detail. Unless you can show that you had that this is not some backdoor way of rezoning something to residential, because I don't understand on apartments. I'm an apartment developer, and it's, you know, I can't conceive that if I'm building a motel and I'm telling you as a city a hotel or motel, and I can use 50% of my units for apartments, that's going to become an apartment complex. It's not going to be a hotel or motel. And that is something you've got to be careful with. And so, again, I do think there's economic analysis are needed. They helped to see what some of the issues are, et cetera. But you got the Coastal Act, you got these safety issues, and you got to be careful how to proceed. But I'm not against timeshares or condo hotels or anything else, as long as the long-term support is that it's going to stay what it was intended and it came to this commission for approval for, that it really is a hotel or a motel or visitor serving, et cetera, and it's not some use that is going to change overnight. And I'm very concerned, especially when you see smaller parcels and projects that are not that large and where people try to do this and achieve this. It's a very difficult thing to do, to mix and have the management have the money to operate and ensure to make sure that those, my example, four units stay a condo hotel, four units this and that. It's very difficult, if not impossible. So those are some of the comments, but I think as our staff does, we're lucky to have such a great staff, and they've been involved in these condo hotels and everything else, and I think they're reaching out here, but I just want to make sure the tsunami studies are something that I think is really a smart thing to do, and also make sure that we understand if you're going to do condo, hotel, or propose one, or motel, or a mixed-use project, that the devil's in the detail, and just make sure that you can afford to monitor and take care of the long-term management of that project so it stays as it was approved.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Schellenberger?
Yeah, I want to add my support to the comments initially made by Commissioner Wan, just to be on record when this comes back that I'll be looking at the same things. And then I wanted to add an observation that I heard the word balance, that we should be balancing things with the economics. And it strikes me that this is one of a good example where we sometimes have a disagreement with cities, with local governments. And we had a meeting, I don't know, quite some time ago with local governments and the commission together. And I often heard people saying, well, we have the same goals. And the truth is we have the same goals. We have very different mandates. Which are not necessarily incompatible, but are different. And so when it comes to coming before the Coastal Commission, the only balancing that our law allows us to do is balancing policies in Chapter 3. We are not authorized under the Coastal Act to balance the economic vision that a city has of itself with coastal resources. So I just kind of point that out, hopefully going forward in the next month as the city and the staff get together, to keep in mind that when we look at this, we're going to have to look at it through the lens of the Coastal Act and really pretty much only the Coastal Act. So I think that's some of the tension that's there now, is that the local government has, in many respects, different mandates than we do. And so hopefully they'll keep in mind, negotiating what comes before us, that that's how we'll be looking at it, is the Coastal Act. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other commissioners? I think that's it then for this item. And if we can, I'd like to go to item 6B and finish that, and then we're going to take a break for about 10 minutes.
And Madam Chair, can I just comment following on that I know it's a lot of work and seems like extra hearings, but I think the continuance model, and we've done it now a couple of times, is really useful for supporting that dialogue that we've been having, and many local governments appreciate that, and we benefit from this kind of feedback directly. So.
All right, thank you. Then we'll go ahead and take item 6B, Bob.
Okay. Item 6B is a concurrence matter, a concurrence with the executive director's determination that the action of Humboldt County to accept the commission certification of a previous LCP amendment is legally adequate. The commission acted on Humboldt County LCP amendment HUM-MAJ-309 back in March, and as submitted, the amendment would change the current zoning designation of a particular site in Mendocino County, from Humboldt County, from coastal commercial timberland to timber production zone. The commission added a modification that would require a six-acre area that had agricultural resources to remain under the former designation, which would allow for ag to continue. The county did act in May to accept and implement that suggested modification, and we're recommending that the commission concur with our determination that the actions taken by the county are legally adequate.
All right. Any ex parte communications on this item? Seeing none, is there any objection to concurrence with the executive director? And seeing none, the commission concurs. And we're going to go ahead and take a break now for about 10 minutes, and then we'll get back to the regular agenda. Thank you. Thank you. Let's reconvene the meeting and get back to the regular agenda and start with item 7A, I think, is next.
Item 7A is an appeal by Friends of Del Norte of a decision of Del Norte County to grant a permit with conditions to Henry Babich for the installation of a 4,608-square-foot storage building off of Standard Vernier Road, 1 mile north of Crescent City in Del Norte County. The appeal raises contentions that the development as approved by the county is inconsistent with the LCP policies relating to wetlands and ESHA protection. The specific contentions are that the storage building will be placed in an area that where there may be evidence that wetlands exist but which have not been identified or delineated, and that the approved project would therefore perhaps involve fill-in wetlands for impermissible uses and would not provide for adequate buffers around those wetlands. Other contentions regard an allegation that there's a lack of a suitable water supply to serve the development due to soil and groundwater contamination from past uses of the site, and that the approved development would have inadequate stormwater drainage plans. Staff is recommending that the commission determine that the appeal does raise a substantial issue of conformance with the LCP with respect to the issues of whether the wetlands have been adequately delineated to ensure consistency with the wetland policies, and consequently also a substantial issue as to whether there's adequate ESHA buffers to protect the wetlands that may be there. Under the commission's procedures, unless three or more commissioners wish to hear about the substantial issue question, the appeal will be presumed to raise a substantial issue. In that case, the commission would move to a de novo hearing on the merits of the project at a later meeting. If three or more commissioners do wish to hear more about the substantial issue and take testimony from the public, I'll present a more detailed presentation. And that concludes my remarks, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, staff. Let me check with the commissioners first to see if there are any ex parte communications starting on my left. Okay, seeing none, as staff indicated, the commission will not take public testimony during the substantial issue phase of the appeal unless three or more commissioners request it. So at this time, are there three or more commissioners who object to the finding of substantial issue? Seeing none, substantial issue has been found. Commissioner Wan?
Just a quick question. The staff report mentioned something about the site having been disked on a regular basis. When they did the disking, do you know whether or not habitat was removed?
Well, the big concern is that we're not completely sure where the habitat is.
Yeah.
And so one of the items of information that we've requested is the full wetland delineation, more comprehensive delineations. And that will tell us where they are will guide
in
us.
In the process of looking at that, because if they did remove habitat in addition to wetlands, obviously our policies are that if the habitat's been removed without the benefit of a permit, then it's as though it wasn't removed. So just
we'll look into that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question, Madam Chair?
Yes. Commissioner Seacole.
Could I inquire from staff? I was hoping we could have the de novo hearing today. I did not understand that it was at a future time. How soon could this hearing occur, if you could tell me?
Well, the biggest factor on the timing is that we've asked for this additional wetland delineation to be done. And so a large part will be under the control of the applicant as to how soon they can provide those. Once they have it, then we'll try to bring it back as soon as we can, given the other workload that we have.
But you've already had one wetlands determination. Isn't that correct?
The county did obtain a wetland delineation, and our view was that while there was a delineation done, the delineation was limited to a small area, and that the procedures that were used, we felt, raised a substantial issue of whether they were adequate or not. So we feel there needs to be a more comprehensive and a more thorough review before we'll have the information that will help us make the recommendation.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Seth.
Okay. That brings us, since there are item 8A, which was the application for DIAS, was approved on consent. That would bring us to item 8B, which is actually on the addendum. And this is the application involving the City of Eureka and the Bureau of Land Management, where they're seeking continued authorization for off-highway vehicle use on a portion of an 80-acre parcel along the foredunes of the Samoa Peninsula. And to present the staff recommendation today is North Coast analyst Melissa Kramer, who prepared the report. Thank you.
Okay. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you. Good morning. I just wanted you to note that in your green addendum that was distributed to you earlier, there are there are at least a dozen letters in support of this application. Staff is recommending approval with special conditions of the proposed continued use and maintenance of a designated 75-acre off-highway vehicle riding area. The use of the foredunes on this property as an OHV riding area has previously been authorized by the Commission on multiple occasions, including an LCP amendment in 1994 and three separate permits in 1998, 2000, and 2005. The authorizations of each of the previously approved permits have been limited to either 2 or 5 year periods. The most recent permit authorization for the OHV use on the subject site expires at the end of this year. The Eureka Dunes riding area is located along the south end of the Samoa Peninsula in Humboldt County on approximately 75 acres of foredunes on property owned by the City of Eureka. The project site is located directly adjacent to the Samoa Dunes OHV riding area managed by the Bureau of Land Management. The Commission approved a consistency determination for the BLM riding area in 1982. The subject site is known to contain populations of rare and endangered plant species and sensitive dune habitats, though most of the foredune area is covered by invasive exotic plants that outcompete and completely displace native dune species. The BLM, under a memorandum of understanding with the city, monitors the site for various sensitive plant and animal species, as detailed in Exhibit 8 of the staff report. Approximately 3 acres of foredunes on the subject property are closed to OHV use to provide for the protection of the rare and endangered plant species and native dune plant communities. Unregulated and indiscriminate riding of OHVs over rare plant ESHA and sensitive dune habitats in Humboldt County historically has posed a threat to these coastal resources. In an effort to address these conflicts, years of intensive study, planning, environmental review, and public involvement, and numerous hearings in the 1990s resulted in the Humboldt County Beach and Dunes Management Plan. Although the Coastal Act, rather than the plan, is the standard of review for the project since the site is within the Commission's retained jurisdiction, the plan provides a framework for managing the beach and dune areas of the North and South Spits, including the subject site. One of the important purposes and outcomes of the Beach and Dunes Management Plan was to determine and specifically define areas where OHVs could or could not be ridden. The plan concluded that the only areas where OHV use would be allowed or proposed are the subject site, the adjacent Samoa Dunes recreation area managed by BLM, and along the wave slope for limited purposes. The remaining areas along the Samoa Peninsula were identified to be closed to vehicle use. The 75-acre portion of the City of Eureka property where the City and BLM now propose to reauthorize and continue the OHV riding area was locally rezoned from natural resources to public recreation and later referenced in the Beach and Dunes Management Plan LCP amendment, which the Commission certified in 1994. The purpose of the local zoning change was to allow for the creation of a well-defined but limited area for additional authorized OHV use while closing the balance of the North and South Spits to vehicles. In its approval of the three previous permits, the Commission found that allowing for riding in this previously disturbed area covered with invasive exotic vegetation is beneficial for the overall protection of environmentally sensitive dune habitat throughout the North Spit. The proposed OHV riding area concentrates vehicle use to the southernmost portion of the North Spit foredunes and establishes a management and enforcement presence that in turn minimizes illegal and indiscriminate riding in other dune areas. Thus, vehicle use is kept restricted to the area previously authorized for OHV use, while minimizing the incidence of OHV trespass and habitat disruption in other dune areas. Confining regulated OHV use to the subject site provides for protection of not only ESHA that is enclosed and excluded from vehicles on the site, but also provides for increased protection of the overall dune system in the area. According to the annual monitoring report submitted over the past 12 years, the project has been successful in protecting the ESHA at the site and limiting OHV riding to the designated trails. The 2010 monitoring report indicates that the endangered beech laya remains one of the most abundant plants in the enclosures. Invasive weeds have been pulled from both enclosures, and native plants are becoming more dominant in the enclosure areas. The applicants note that there is no evidence of any trespass by OHV riders into the ESHA enclosures and that users have abided by all the guidelines established by the BLM thus far. And the report concludes that overall the quality of the native plant communities within the enclosures appears to be stable, and the post and cable barriers are being respected by OHV users. Staff recommends 5 special conditions similar to those imposed in the previous permits to ensure that the proposed project will avoid significant disruption to and provide for the continuance of the rare and endangered plant species in native dune grass adjacent to the riding area. In a larger sense, authorization of the OHV use in this well-defined but limited area will continue to relieve the pressure caused by indiscriminate riding on sensitive habitat areas throughout the balance of the nearly 3,500 acres of open dunes, which are set aside for habitat protection under Humboldt County's LCP. And the motion to adopt the staff recommendation of approval with special conditions is found on page 6 of your staff report. That concludes my presentation.
All right. Thank you, staff. Let me check first with commissioners to see if there are any ex parte communications, starting on my left. All right. Seeing none, then we'll open the public hearing and note that we have Lisa Chicaney here from the City of Eureka to answer questions, and we have Bruce Kahn from the Bureau of Land Management. Bruce, would you like to come first? And oh, your questions only as well?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Sorry. And then, I mean, that's okay with us. And then we have 2 speakers from the public, Diane Beck and Maggie Herbelin. So, Diane, would you like to come up first? We'll give you 3 minutes.
My words are on behalf of the North Group.
Just state your name for the record, sorry.
Oh, Diane Beck.
Thank you.
From Neyland.
Thank you.
Okay. My words are on behalf of the North Group Redwood Chapter Sierra Club, with around 1,100 members on the North Coast. The City of Eureka is fortunate in having BLM to manage its OHV riding area on the North Spit of Humboldt Bay. The area is accessed through the Sunrise to Sunset Gate at the entrance to BLM's Samoa Dunes Recreation Area and is an extension of that area. We noted in the staff report documents an apparent downward trend in the number of bird species since 2005, but are unclear about the significance. While the Sierra Club is no fan of recreational OHVs, especially on California beaches, the North Group supports your staff recommendation of approval with conditions. We can think of no more capable agency by far to manage the City of Eureka's foredunes than BLM's conscientious and dedicated Arcata field office. Thank
right.
you.
Thank you. Maggie Herbelin, is Maggie still here? Yeah.
Good morning. I'm Maggie Herbelin, and I have 2 or 3 hats on today to support this continued use of the Beach and Dunes Management Plan. Every year, the Humboldt Bay Stewards receives a letter to support the application of our local sheriff's department to apply for a grant to do more beach observance and enforcement. And we think that the fact that we have this ordinance in place and this specific area for our OH vehicles to use has created a better ability for law enforcement to oversight these things. And I think that the monitoring program that has been put together to watch over our very sensitive areas that are out there and has limited the use of our beach areas, our dune areas, to a specific area has been very, very beneficial to the rest of our beach and dunes. And the third hat I'm wearing is the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary hat. The Bureau of Land Management and the Auxiliary are currently discussing having the Auxiliary also have a presence out on the dunes to sort of have a presence and monitor the proper use of this space. So thank you for your time, and I support this ordinance.
All right, thank you. Okay, and that's the end of our speakers, so bring it back to staff. Any other comments from staff?
No, Madam Chair.
All right, so bring it back to the commission. The motion is on page 6. Commissioner Wan?
Just a quick question or comment, and I am want to thank the BLM because they have kept their word and have used this as a good example of how if you provide one area for the OHV use, but you police the other areas, that you can sort of live together. And I don't know if I'm correct, but you've been removing the invasive species within the fenced-in area, but I don't know if you've been removing any of the invasive species, and I'm assuming not, from outside of the fenced-in area. And you might want to consider doing that, because if you remove them from the outside, you will have less problem within the fenced-in areas. So maybe the gentleman from the BLM could come up and I could discuss this with you.
Okay. Bruce Kahn.
Dr. Dan at
Cox.net. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Bruce Kahn.
Would you be object to having at least the suggestion in the staff conditions that the BLM start to consider removal of these invasive species plants from the outside of the fenced-in area? Because the fact is, if you get rid of them, you won't have to then deal with them within the fenced-in area. That's where that's how it gets reinvaded. So I don't know if that's a problem for you. I'm not going to suggest it be a requirement, but just a suggestion that that's something that you do.
Okay. I personally don't have any problem with the suggestion. And Jennifer Wheeler, she's our botanist here. Can she speak more directly to that? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wheeler. I'm the botanist with the Arcata Field Office that's been conducting the monitoring for the last 12 years. It's kind of a balancing act. Maintaining those enclosures takes minimal effort from the CCC every year. I could probably handle it myself if I dedicated a few days to doing it. If the thing is, if we, and I'm for more habitat, but the riders aren't, if you provide them open sand and open habitat, they will ride there. If we start pulling outside the enclosures, I fear they will ride there. So native plants might start coming in, but they're more likely to ride there.
No, I think
you know what I mean?
I think you're misunderstanding me. I'm not talking about just pulling them. Maybe I misstated relative to the enclosures, but in the area where it's not protected habitat. So in the
open riding area that is outside the enclosure,
right.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
If we start pulling the beach grass, the riders don't want to go over the beach grass or through the bush lupin. I actually have a monitoring transect in the open riding area, hoping that the riders would actually ride around in there and kind of rip it up so that I could see some native plants start to come in. And there's been a little of it on the edges where there's some established trails, but they really don't want, they don't see, after 12 years, they haven't.
Okay, I think you've answered my questions.
Okay.
You're actually thinking about that.
Yeah, we
so
have
that's
been.
Fine.
Yeah.
The big concern for me is, of course, the more invasive plants you have, the more likely you are to have them reinvade. And so that was my concern. But it sounds like you're actually doing that.
Yeah, the beach spreads rhizomatously, and we can really maintain that edge pretty easily.
Right, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Secord?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the Commission approve CDP number 1-10-017 pursuant to the staff recommendation. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
We have a motion by Commissioner Secord, a second by Commissioner Kruer. The maker and seconder are recommending a yes vote. Passage of the motion will result in approval of the permit as condition and adoption of the resolutions and findings in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No, thank you, ma'am.
Commissioner Kruer?
No, thank you,
ma'am. All right. Commissioner Sanchez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a follow-up question from that of Commissioner Juan, because on our field trip yesterday, and actually in driving around, I've noticed pampas grass is a huge problem for the area. And I'll tell you, in our area, we in the city of Oceanside, we ended up banning it because it in the river, it ends up in the river, one plant will, in its lifetime, could produce a million plants, right? So I know you know that. But in Southern California, we have the issue of water, scarcity of water, and they take up a lot of water, along with not allowing native habitat to grow. Do you have to basically chemically treat to remove it? You're shaking your head. That's what we have found, because if you don't do that, then it continues to grow.
No.
You need to state your name for the record, ma'am.
My name is Jennifer Wheeler. I'm the botanist with the Arcata Field Office. I'm also the invasive weed specialist and have been the head of the Humboldt County weed management area for many years, and I assist the coordinator on that and have treated pampas grass in the King Range and many other areas that we manage, and I've never used chemical methods. I've also treated pampas grass in the Headwaters Forest Reserve, and it's all been manual. It basically, if you just get the root ball out, it doesn't resprout from the little remaining lateral roots that are left there. You can also keep it from spreading from just cutting off the fronds. And those seeds are only viable for about 6 to 8 weeks once they're produced and released. So it really needs to fall on fertile soil. It does spread really easily, but you can control it manually. If it gets really widespread and dense, then you're probably looking at chemical control. But if you are expeditious and get on it right away, it's totally feasible to take care of it manually.
Right, and I guess that's what I was, that's been my experience, is that you treat it chemically, and then after that, it is a manual. You do have to constantly watch it, because it can come from a different part of the area.
Well, it's a wind-dispersed seed, so it can travel on the wind current from quite a distance.
Right.
But you can treat it manually the first time. It's really easy to pull out while the plants are small. And it takes a couple years before it'll produce a frond. So if you get it in the first year, you don't even have to worry about that. You can just pull it out.
And is that, are you finding that just doing it within the enclosed area, you're able to maintain that?
We don't really have a problem with pampas grass on the Samoa Peninsula on our lands. I patrol and treat it, and we have the Malell Dunes Management Area that I patrol, and we treat it manually. In Headwaters, we've treated it all along the public trails, and in most areas it gets shaded out where the forest is coming back in. It is light. It needs full sun. It's not shade tolerant.
We were actually, we had a field trip, and it was all over in the city of Samoa. So I guess you're telling me area
I'm
that
talking
you're
about the BLM. Yeah, I just manage the BLM land. So yeah, right. Over by Fairhaven. Yeah, it's really thick over there.
Right.
And it can blow over to our areas.
You need to educate them about how to get rid of the pampas grass.
Yeah, they're looking at a massive manual effort or some chemical control, but the water table out there is really high, and I'd shy away from that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. Could we have a roll call vote on this item, please? We have a motion and a second. We'd like a roll call vote.
Commissioner Blank.
What is the maker asking for?
Yes.
Yes.
Blank, yes. Commissioner Bloom.
Yes.
Bloom, yes. Commissioner Secord.
Yes.
Secord, yes. Commissioner Kruer?
Yeah.
Kruer, yes. Commissioner Mercurimi?
Yes.
Mercurimi, yes. Commissioner Sanchez?
Yes.
Sanchez, yes. Commissioner Schellenberger?
No.
Schellenberger, no. Commissioner Stone?
Yes.
Stone, yes. Commissioner Juan?
Yes.
Juan, yes. Chair Neely?
Yes.
Chair Neely, yes. The vote is 9-1.
All right. The commission hereby approves the coastal development permit for this proposed development.
Thank you, staff.
Madam Chair, that was our last agendized item, but I believe the Chief Counsel or Attorney General wants to make a brief report to you on another decision.
All right, great. So we'll go to the Deputy Attorney General.
Good morning, Chair Neely and Commissioners. I do have a report on a matter that I learned about yesterday afternoon.
Okay.
The case is Porter versus County of Santa Cruz. And in this case, the Porters challenged a commission certification of the Santa Cruz County LCP with modifications. The Porters raised a number of challenges, and on Monday, the court rejected all of their arguments, denying the writ of mandate. And the case was handled by Joel Jacobs in our Oakland office.
All right.
In case you didn't hear that was in Santa Cruz County, an LCP amendment concerning community character that you heard a year or so ago.
Okay. Very good. Any questions for staff on that item? All right. Anything else before the commission? Do we need to take another public comment? I don't have any speaker slips, so I was just wondering. Okay, we've got that covered. All right. Thanks, everybody, for a great meeting, and we'll see you next month.
Madam Chair,
thank you again.
Just before we quit, I wanted to thank yourself and the county for providing the wonderful meeting last night, the wonderful dinner, and the chance for collegial activities, and the food and the cheese and the whole thing. It's been very nice.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Thank you.